I next met with Dr. Ian Kropp from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and to begin, Dr. Kropp presented a patient from his practice.
So I saw a 68-year-old woman who presented with a palpable mass. She is biopsied and found to have a strongly estrogen and progesterone receptor positive, HER2 negative, moderately differentiated breast cancer. And unfortunately, she also had some axillary adenopathy, and she went on to have a lumpectomy with axillary dissection, which demonstrated about a 4-centimeter cancer in the breast with negative margins, but 5 of 20 lymph nodes that were involved. And given that anatomic risk, that she had significant nodal involvement, I think her primary oncologist was thinking that adjuvant chemotherapy prior to hormonal therapy would make the most sense, and she placed a port and was getting her set up to start chemotherapy, and the patient came down to see me for a second opinion. And while certainly chemotherapy is a very reasonable approach for someone with multiple lymph nodes involved, I was struck by the biology of her cancer, which, based on the strong hormone receptor expression and lack of high-grade histology, I was feeling that this was very likely a cancer that chemotherapy was not going to make a big impact. And this, in addition, in this particular patient who was 68 and she has significant obesity, she has pretty bad osteoarthritis, and she'd already had one hip replaced and needed another hip and really wasn't very mobile, I was also worried she would be more at risk for the complications of chemotherapy. So based on the presumed biology and the fact, which would to me imply that chemotherapy may not have much of a significant impact, and the fact that she was at increased risk for complications of chemotherapy, I did think she was a patient who performing an Oncotype DX assay would be helpful. We don't have as much data on multiple lymph node positive patients as we do node negative patients with Oncotype, but the data we do have would seem to suggest that the node positive biology is fairly similar to node negatives in that patients with low risk Oncotype scores really don't benefit much from chemotherapy. So we had this discussion. The patient was very concerned about the toxicities of chemotherapy and therefore really did feel that trying to get a better sense of the biology of her cancer was worthwhile. So we did send an Oncotype. I talked to her primary oncologist who was completely on board with that. We got an Oncotype and it came back with a score of 14, which is squarely within the low risk range. And if you look at the data from the Oncotype analysis of Kathy Albane's study, this is a population that really does not seem to benefit from chemotherapy. They overall have a higher risk of recurrence, but chemotherapy doesn't seem to impact that. So based on that Oncotype score, I did recommend that she proceed with an aromatase inhibitor and not do chemotherapy.
And I see that she actually ended up on a clinical trial.
Right. So these are patients in whom we don't think chemotherapy is likely to be helpful, so we'd like to maximize the benefit of hormonal therapy. And we're trying to explore ways to do that. Right now, in terms of standard of care for a postmenopausal patient, there really isn't anything else besides aromatase inhibitor therapy that's going to make an additional difference. But of course, we're exploring additional types of targeted therapies to try to improve the efficacy of hormonal therapy. So one of the ways that we think may be possible to do that is by adding a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Obviously, we're all aware of the data in the metastatic setting that these drugs seem to improve the efficacy of hormonal therapy. So the natural next step is to see whether that also holds true in the adjuvant setting. So we currently have a trial called PALLAS, which is exploring the benefit of palbociclib in addition to hormonal therapy in higher risk ER-positive patients. There are other trials getting underway looking at the other CDK4/6 inhibitors as well. So I do think right now we obviously have no data that this is going to be a beneficial approach, but it's certainly a question that we need to ask.
But this is phase 3, and is it blinded? Do you know what she's getting?
This is a phase 3 trial. This particular trial is not blinded. There's no placebo control. And the rationale for that was that given the incredibly high rate of neutropenia with palbociclib, that there really would be no purpose in doing a placebo control because everybody's going to know which arm you're on.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
And it adds extra monitoring for the patients who are, if you're on a placebo, you don't need that. So this particular trial is not blinded. I think some of the other adjuvant trials may be blinded, and I think that's just a decision that different companies are making.
And is she getting the palbo?
She is. She just started. She just finished her post-lumpectomy radiation and was just put on the study. So I don't have much experience yet with her on how she's tolerating the palbociclib.
In other patients that you've seen, if you've had other patients who've got palbo, what do you typically see in terms of the counts? And is there any kind of quality of life thing that you can pick up in terms of toxicity or side effects?
Yeah, so I have a reasonable amount of experience with patients in the metastatic setting getting palbociclib. And it's variable. I mean, certainly neutropenia is very common, and many patients end up needing a dose reduction to deal with the neutropenia. But in terms of quality of life, I actually find that the things that we see from the clinical trial data would suggest that fatigue and diarrhea and some hair thinning are common toxicities. Certainly neutropenia is present. I haven't had much trouble with my patients getting diarrhea for whatever reason. People do notice fatigue, and fatigue is one of those things that I think is very variable from patient to patient. Some patients really have a lot of trouble with it. Others don't at all. And I have no idea why there's this variability.
What an incredible case. 5 positive nodes and amazing that she ends up on palbo. I mean, if I were the patient, kind of like, I think that's what I want. But how about if I go back to you and say, maybe ideally this lady should have had a genomic assay, and we'll talk about which one she had, the 21 gene. Ideally, she should have had it pre-op when she was first diagnosed, and it should have guided pre-op therapy.
I think that's an interesting question, and it's funny you mentioned that, because we actually are starting to do preoperative genomic testing, but we're doing it in a specific population, which is, I think, the one you're alluding to, which is patients in whom you're considering doing preoperative therapy, postmenopausal, or pre or post, but with hormone receptor positive, non-high-grade tumors, that you're really not sure what the benefit of chemotherapy is. And what you're doing in the preoperative setting is you're trying to cytoreduce the cancer to potentially change someone from needing a mastectomy to being a breast conservation candidate. And you want to do that with the most effective therapy you can. And with these hormone receptor positive cancers, certainly chemotherapy is not the answer to all of them. And, you know, there are older data randomizing preoperative patients to chemotherapy or hormonal therapy, which seem to suggest that actually hormonal therapy led to better clinical responses than the chemotherapy. And I think that just goes along with what all we've learned in the last 10 or 20 years, that these non-high-grade ER-positive cancers really are fairly unresponsive or insensitive to chemotherapy, and that hormonal therapy is really the best way to attack them.
Although there are people who do have ER-positive, HER2-negative tumors that, for example, have high 21 gene recurrence scores, and you know, maybe that wouldn't be predicted in this situation, but it certainly could occur. I think if this lady had either HER2-positive, triple-negative disease, she would have gotten neoadjuvant therapy. My question is, if she had a high recurrence score, would you have preferred giving her neoadjuvant chemo?
Yeah, so I think that's exactly how we're using this. So if I would have met her on day one rather than after she's had her surgery, I would have offered her preoperative therapy. I do agree with you that I think that that would, when someone has multiple positive lymph nodes, especially, you know, palpable lymph nodes, that the surgeons prefer neoadjuvant. And before you do that, you kind of want to know what's likely to be the most effective treatment. And so doing a genomic assay in that population, I think, is a very reasonable thing. And that's actually what we're doing. We actually have preoperative clinical trials now for both chemotherapy-based trials as well as hormonal therapy-based trials for ER-positive patients. And we're using genomic assays to help steer patients to which one of those we think is most appropriate, as well as non-trial options.
It kind of seems like this is an emerging trend. When we survey investigators, maybe half or less do that. So, you know, not everybody's doing it, but we do hear a substantial number of people who do. The other question I have, particularly in view of your recent publication that we want to talk about, is your choice of genomic assay. You chose in this patient with 5 positive nodes to use the 21 gene, and the obvious alternative, there are a number of alternatives, but particularly the 70 gene. And of course, I wanted to ask you about the publication of the paper that came out looking at that from the MINDEC trial.
Right. So you're right that we now have different options. I think from my personal standpoint at Dana-Farber, where I work, we have a lot of experience with Oncotype. We've been using it now for a number of years, and it's something that we're comfortable with. But now that there are starting to be more data with the 70-gene assay or MammaPrint, and it no longer requires frozen tissue, that that's also a very appropriate test. I mean, the interesting thing is MammaPrint gives you a yes-no result, whereas Oncotype gives you a continuous score. There's pros and cons. When you're making decisions for patients, there's something inherently nice about having a dichotomous score, because then you don't really have to waver about what to do with the intermediate scores. But I think we have enough experience with Oncotype that we are very comfortable with that. But I think it's kind of an evolving area. Our general sense is that all of these tests, the MammaPrint, Oncotype, PAM50, are probably measuring similar things. And which particular test you use may not matter. And I think it's just something that you want to be comfortable with, understanding the scores, understanding the report, and how that influences your decision making.
So that does tie into some of the papers that have come out. There was an ASCO guidelines paper that came out previously about the use of genomic assays that I was surprised pretty much said, don't use genomic assays in patients with node-positive tumors. Dan Hayes was on that paper,
right,
which was interesting because we know that a lot of, if not the majority of investigators, as you demonstrate in this case, were actually doing it. They said, don't do it. And then more recently, just very recently, actually, you had a paper, you know, it was an ASCO guideline paper specifically addressing the issue of the 70-gene assay. Can you talk about kind of what the point was that you were trying to make in that paper and globally the way and, you know, what the guideline process is about the whole issue of using genomic assays in patients with node-positive tumors?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's a good question. And again, it's an evolving field. I mean, the original ASCO guidelines, which, as you said, Dan Hayes was heavily involved in, felt, as I also mentioned, that the data for Oncotype in node-positive patients is limited. We have one retrospective analysis of a prospective study, and the number of node-positive patients was not large that were evaluable. And because of that limited data, I think the panel at that point felt that it wasn't yet appropriate to use that assay in most patients, knowing that you may be telling a patient that they don't need chemotherapy when the benefits of chemotherapy may be still significant. I think that that's kind of a philosophical question of how much data does one need before you put something into clinical practice. The updated ASCO guideline panel, which you mentioned, happened because there were new data, and the new data came from this prospective study of the 70-gene assay. And so based on these new data and the way the ASCO guideline are set up now is that we want to keep this a kind of an evolving process and not something that becomes obsolete because you wait 2 or 3 years between each change. So the way the process is set up is that if there is a new data set that we think may impact clinical decision making, that is then reviewed by the ASCO expert panel and used to reevaluate the guidelines. And so that's what happened when the MammaPrint data came out from the MINDAC study. So this was a very specific change to the guidelines. It only pertained to MammaPrint, the 70-gene assay, and MINDACT. The trial included a pretty wide range of tumors, both node-negative, node-positive. The lack of utility of MammaPrint is not in node-negative per se. It's in patients who are determined to be low clinical risk.
Okay.
And that included a lot of node-negative cancers. It actually included a few node-positive cancers. And so the determination of low clinical risk is done using an adjuvant online-based type of categorization. But I think...
Which is not online, so... but yeah. So basically clinical
right.
staging. So,
right.
Yeah, of course, if you have a 4-centimeter node-negative tumor, you're talking about smaller node-negative tumors, I guess,
right.
or...
Right, no, that's it, right. You're right that adjuvant online, unfortunately, is not online right now, but we did include the way you can do it on your own in the manuscript. But essentially, the idea is low clinical risk patients aren't going to need chemotherapy no matter how biologically sensitive they are to chemotherapy because they're going to do well regardless. And so where the utility comes in...
That's with 70 gene.
Correct.
Okay.
That's with the data we have from the 70 gene assay in the MINDAC trial. What we're trying to say is that if you have a patient who has a high clinical risk as defined by that trial, and obviously that's an argument where you draw the line between low and high clinical risk, but if it's a patient who has a high clinical risk as defined by the trial, that the MammaPrint assay, if you come back with a low score, a low genomic risk score, would suggest the benefits that that patient's going to do well and that it's unlikely that chemotherapy is going to make a big impact on further reducing their risk. So the major data set from MINDACT, and it was a little bit of a somewhat complicated design, in my opinion, but the major point was not so much the predictive value, it was more the prognostic value, meaning if in a patient population who has a high clinical risk, if you get a low genomic risk score from MINDACT, that patient population is likely to do well with hormonal therapy alone. It doesn't specifically exclude a benefit of chemotherapy, but it says that they're likely to do well without it anyway. There is a randomization in that trial, and in that randomization, it did not appear that chemotherapy offered additional benefit, either in the node positives or in the node negatives, about a 1% difference. And you can't just look at the cancer, you have to look at the patient as well. I would say in a 70-year-old woman, a 1.2 centimeter ER positive, node negative cancer, I'm not going to do a genomic assay on that patient. Again, because their risk of complications from chemotherapy are higher and competing risk of mortality. But in a 32-year-old, I am going to do a genomic test for that 1.2 centimeter cancer.
And, you know, we tease this out all the time with our surveys, but just out of curiosity in terms of, yes, you have to individualize it, but 2.2 centimeters node negative in a 70-year-old woman?
No, I wouldn't do it in that patient either.
That's interesting.
But I would in a 60-year-old. I mean, at Dana-Farber now, we reflexively do Oncotype for 1 centimeter greater cancers who patients under the age of 65 or so. But I think everybody has to be comfortable with where they draw that line. And I think, as you said, you have to tailor it to the patient as well. It's not just the biology of the cancer that matters.
It appears, at least from this case, and I guess there are other cases, that you will consider a genomic assay. Sounds like you prefer 21 gene in some node positive patients.
Yeah, I do. And I agree that right now that's counter to the current ASCO guidelines, but I think that's going to evolve as well. And obviously we will have randomized data from Oncotype once the Taylor X trial comes out and eventually in node positive patients as well. I think it's worth, just to me at least, highlighting the fact that I really do think that these genomic assays have, next to HER2-directed therapy, have probably had the biggest impact on our care of patients in breast cancer of anything in the last 20 years. I mean, I think the fact that most oncologists, and you have experience with this from your surveys, are getting comfortable using these assays, and we're cutting down the use of chemotherapy substantially. There are now studies showing, you know, that oftentimes these assays can help change decision-making in almost half the patients in whom they're used. And I just think these have really been a tremendous improvement in our care, and I'm glad that people are now comfortable with them.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I don't know whether people who are sort of newer to oncology realize that, I mean, this has really maybe been 10 to 12 years that the data came out. And prior to that time, there was a consensus conference, I think it was in 2000, that said everybody with a tumor over 1 centimeter gets chemo.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And that seems so archaic right now. And you're right, it's not very long ago. And it's, you know, it just shows you that we all kind of knew that the chemotherapy was not likely to be very beneficial in those patients, but having that objective genomic score makes it a lot easier to talk to patients and makes us feel a lot more comfortable deferring chemotherapy in that patient. And I think it's been a big deal.
The other paper I wanted to ask you about relating to the issue of adjuvant chemotherapy is, we had seen the data first presented, now it's been published in the JCO, from the so-called ABC trials, looking at anthracycline. Seems like in a lot of ways we kind of gotten beyond some of these questions, but some of these trials are still reporting. What did they look at here? And from your point of view, what did it mean?
I actually thought that was an impressive data set. We have these old data that were comparing anthracyclines to non-anthracycline chemotherapy. And some of them did show a slight benefit to anthracyclines. And if you look at the Oxford overview, which did a meta-analysis of many of those trials, there was a slight benefit to anthracyclines. But a lot of people weren't quite sure about that. A lot of those older trials included HER2-positive patients not treated with trastuzumab. So we know that anthracyclines are an effective drug in that population. So I do think that despite the fact that this is 2017, that the anthracycline question was still a little bit up in the air, especially given that there was this randomized trial comparing AC versus TC, which seemed to show a little benefit against anthracyclines. So I think it was an open question. I think the investigators of the ABC consortium did a nice thing. They took 3 different trials, all of which were relatively small, and they did a combined analysis. And by doing that, we got enough patients, I think a little bit over 4,000 patients, to be able to make a conclusive result rather than three inconclusive results, which I think is probably what would have happened. So what they did is they combined three trials that all compared a TC, or docetaxel cyclophosphamide regimen, six cycles, versus various anthracycline taxane regimens in a mix of ER-positive and triple-negative breast cancers. And this was a non-inferiority analysis, trying to show that a non-anthracycline regimen was non-inferior to a anthracycline taxane. And what they found was that the TC regimen did not meet the non-inferiority boundary. In fact, it was statistically inferior. But interestingly, essentially all of that benefit was in triple-negative patients and high-risk ER-positive patients, which, again, I think is consistent with what some of the previous studies have shown, but it really was nice to have it fairly in concrete terms. So I think the bottom line is, if you have a high-risk patient, particularly a triple-negative patient, it makes sense to still use an anthracycline. For lower-risk patients, there does not seem to be a added benefit to using anthracyclines, and using a non-anthracycline regimen is very reasonable.
I don't know exactly what the statistical rules were here in this study, but I've been trying to see whether there's a hazard rate. I'm not sure if they were allowed to get one, but I mean, the absolute difference was actually extremely small. In your mind, and maybe it's in the paper and I don't see it here, what's the hazard rate for improvement when you add an anthracycline?
And again, I don't remember exactly the number, but the hazard rate was around 1.2 something, I think. But I think what's important is that you have to look at the subsets. And although there was not a strict interaction term, if you looked specifically within the ER-positive population, all the benefit was in the node-positive ER-positive, not in the node-negative ER-positive, and the benefit was in triple-negatives. And within those groups, the benefit was more substantial than in the overall population, which, as I said, the hazard rate, I think, was around 1.2 or 1.22 or something.
It kind of seems like it's falling into that modest improvement that you can barely detect. But from your own global sense, without giving me a scientific answer, because, you know, kind of 20% reduction is about as low as you can get and still be there. But it sounds like you believe that it's greater with, for example, triple negative.
Right. I think, and again, we're always, I think, more comfortable accepting something that confirms what you already believe, which probably isn't the best way to look at data. But you're right. I mean, I think the overall difference was very modest, as you said. But within the high-risk patients, the benefit seemed to be more substantial.
As long as we brought up anthracyclines, what's your view in terms of the issue of anthracyclines and HER2-positive disease?
Yeah, so that's a little bit more complicated. And I still think there's no right answer because we have limited randomized data. But I think that right now, it's reasonable to use either an anthracycline regimen or a non-anthracycline regimen using TCH. I don't think we have a conclusive data set that would tell us that anthracyclines are not needed anymore, and we don't have one that says that docetaxel-based treatment is completely the way to go for everybody.
So I'd like to hear about your case, too. We were talking about CDK4/6 inhibitors with your first case. So the lady got on this adjuvant trial. Incidentally, I was going to ask you before, when this lady went on the adjuvant trial, 5 positive nodes. If a patient with 5 positive nodes like this came to you, particularly if it was a low 21 gene score, and said, I'll pay for the palbo, will you write for it adjuvantly?
I would not do that.
Really? Interesting.
As you know, there have been a number of studies that have looked at drugs that looked very promising in the metastatic setting that did not pan out in the adjuvant setting.
Absolutely.
And, you know, this is a novel class of drug. It causes a cell cycle arrest. It is possible that this drug for 2 years, you know, these trials are using the drug, or at least the PALLAS trial uses the palbociclib for 2 years. It's very possible, I mean, I hope this is not the case, but it's very possible that, you know, you can arrest the micrometastatic disease for 2 years, and then as soon as you stop the palbo, their cells are going to start growing again, and you'll have no long-term benefit. Again, I hope that's not the case, but it's certainly a possibility. So I think this is very much of an unproven hypothesis that palbociclib is going to meaningfully impact recurrence over time. Again, I think we're all optimistic, but it's certainly far from proven, and that's why this trial needs to be done, and that's why it's randomized and not just everybody getting the drug. So I don't think we should be using CDK inhibitors in the adjuvant setting outside of a clinical trial.
I do want to get to her too, because there are a couple of things going on there, but maybe you can just briefly talk about your next case, the 56-year-old woman, in terms of the issue of CDK4/6 inhibition. Maybe you can talk about this lady when she first presented with metastatic disease and what happened since that point.
So this is a very nice woman who initially presented with what we originally thought was a, you know, primary localized breast cancer. It was a strongly estrogen receptor positive, progesterone receptor positive, HER2 negative. And during her workup, she mentioned that she'd been having some back pain for the last 6 months or so. And even though it didn't look like she was at high risk because of the pain, I did perform staging studies. And unfortunately, she had some bone disease.
And she had lobular?
She had a lobular breast cancer. You know, I think if this was a ductal ER-positive breast cancer, it would be the same situation. But she had clear concerning findings on scans, and so we did biopsy the bone, and it did come back conclusive for metastatic adenocarcinoma that was estrogen receptor positive. So based on that, we did not move ahead with standard adjuvant treatment, and instead put her on an aromatase inhibitor, a bisphosphonate, and I can't remember whether ovarian suppression at the time, because
she did.
Can't remember whether she was premenopausal at
that point. Yes, she had anastrozole ovarian suppression.
Yeah. And her pain got a little better. Her scans over time showed sclerosis. It looked like she was responding. Her tumor markers came down. And, you know, I think this was back, she started hormonal therapy about 4 or 5 months before the unexpected, you know, accelerated approval of palbociclib. And so when that happened, a lot of us talked to our patients about this new development. And, you know, we talked about potentially adding palbociclib to the aromatase inhibitor, but I suggested that she didn't do that, and she was comfortable with that. And my rationale was we had, at that point, no data on adding a CDK inhibitor to a pre-existing hormonal therapy regimen. We still don't have any data on that. And she was doing well, and since she had de novo disease, we had every expectation that she would have a long disease-free interval or progression-free interval on the hormonal therapy alone. So adding palbociclib adds toxicity, adds monitoring, and she was doing well on this therapy alone. And that changed just a few months ago. She started having a little bit more pain. We did an imaging. She had a single new bone lesion in the femur, and her tumor markers were up. So she was clearly progressing at that point. And so we switched her to fulvestrant and palbociclib. And since then, her pain's gotten better, and it looks like she's responding.
She's having an objective response?
Well, I mean, she doesn't have measurable disease, so she can't technically have an objective response by RECIST anyway, but her pain's better, her scans looked a little better, and she didn't have a whole lot going on to begin with. We could have a whole conversation about how to follow patients with bone-only disease, but clinically, I think she's improving.
I think there are a couple of clinical questions this case brings up. I am kind of curious because I know being in your center, people get a lot of assays. I don't know if she's had any kind of genomic assays. You've written about the estrogen receptor mutations. Did you look for that in her?
So we have, but it's a little difficult because the only tissue we have from her is her primary biopsy.
Right, right. And the bone.
And the bone. And there wasn't enough tissue there to do DNA analysis on the bone.
Interesting.
So we don't know. On her primary cancer, she doesn't have any obvious actionable mutations. We've looked. We do that in all of our metastatic patients.
As long as we brought it up, and again, you've looked at this issue, could you talk about what these mutations are and at this point kind of what they mean?
Yeah, and then of course, then the next question is how do you find them? So what they are mutations in the ligand binding domain of the estrogen receptor. So they're a specific area of the gene. And what they do is they basically lock the estrogen receptor into an active conformation. And so if in the laboratory, if you take these mutated estrogen receptors, they still have their normal activation function, but even in the absence of estrogen. So essentially, this is an estrogen receptor that's on regardless of whether there's estrogen around. And of course, that's a problem because at least aromatase inhibitors and tamoxifen work by blocking the estrogen, binding to the estrogen receptor in one way or another. And so if the estrogen receptor doesn't care about estrogen anymore, then that's going to make the cancer somewhat immune to the effects of these kinds of estrogen, anti-estrogen drugs.
And particularly those that try to take away the ligand.
Right. So you're right. So that's where tamoxifen and aromatase. So that's why there was hope, at least, that drugs that degrade the estrogen receptor, like fulvestrant, would still be active in patients who have a estrogen receptor mutation in their cancer. And that does appear to be the case. If you look, they've done some retrospective analyses of some of the randomized trials comparing aromatase inhibitors versus fulvestrant, and the effectiveness of the aromatase inhibitors definitely seems to be compromised if you have an estrogen receptor mutation, whereas fulvestrant still seems to be relatively active. So it does look like degrading the estrogen receptor is still at least moderately active, even in this presence of an ESR1 mutation.
So, and I guess if you have someone who hasn't gotten anything, if you knew they had a mutation, then I guess you would start with fulvestrant?
Yes, except here's the thing. These estrogen receptor mutations don't happen in primary cancers. They only seem to occur as a way of becoming resistant to an aromatase inhibitor. So if they, at least the larger data set so far would say that you don't find the estrogen receptor mutations in patients who haven't had an aromatase inhibitor.
So actually, as we were talking, I thought of a question I haven't asked anybody before, and I'm dying to know the answer because we worked a lot with your colleague Jeff Oxnard in lung cancer.
Yeah.
He's had a leading role in looking in lung cancer for mutations in the serum and the plasma assays. What about looking in the plasma for ER mutations?
Yeah, so as usual, you're always ahead of the game. So you're right. So that does look like the way to find these estrogen receptor mutations.
Wow, interesting.
And so in fact, most of the large data sets that have been analyzed using circulating DNA. A lot of our patients have these bone-only cancers, and so it's hard to do these assays on DNA from the bone. So most of the data has been with circulating DNA.
I didn't even know that. So for example, does Guardant 360 pick this up?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So yeah, so that does seem like that's the way to go. And all of the correlative studies that have been done on most of the metastatic ER-positive trials lately, looking both for ESR1 mutations and PI3 kinase mutations, have been done using circulating DNA. I think that we need to do a better job of getting this to be both clinically available, and we need to, at the same time, we need to be able to tell doctors what to do with that information. Because right now, we don't have any prospective studies that would say, oh, if you have an ESR1 mutation, you should definitely avoid an aromatase inhibitor, you should only use fulvestrant. And we think that may be the case, but we don't really know that. So we need to do trials to tell oncologists what to do with the information that they're going to start getting from ctDNA assays.
So I don't know if you view this as, quote, again, I'm thinking about the lung model. I don't know if you view this as a driver mutation, but I mean, tamoxifen's not a TKI. Are there TKIs that theoretically could hit these ER mutations?
Probably not. ER is not a kinase. So the best approach right now looks like just get rid of the estrogen receptor. And so we already have fulvestrant, but fulvestrant is not an ideal drug because of pharmacokinetic issues. So I think a lot of interest right now is developing new estrogen receptor degraders. And there's a series of what we call SERDs. So kind of like tamoxifen is a SERM, which is a selective estrogen receptor modulator. These are selective estrogen receptor degraders. So they're oral drugs that both block estrogen binding as well as degrade the estrogen receptor. And there was some interesting data from one of them presented at ASCO this year, which showed some decent amount of clinical activity in pretreated patients. Maura Dickler had presented some data. So it does look like these drugs are active, and there's a number of them kind of making their way through the development process. So that could be one way to overcome these estrogen receptor mutations.
That's fascinating. I always thought fulvestrant was a really cool drug, but it just sort of came in and sat there for a long time. This case, getting back to your case, does bring up a couple other issues. First of all, looking at this retrospectively, I mean, she was diagnosed before, or she had Mets before PABO was even approved, but would you have given her PALBO up front? And are there patients right now who you're giving first-line endocrine therapy where you don't use a CDK inhibitor? And I'll just throw in, how do you choose between RIBO and PALBO?
Yeah. So those are all not necessarily easy questions, and they're important things right now as we start learning how to use these drugs. So does everybody need to be on a CDK inhibitor in the first line? I don't think so. This patient I just talked to you about is a perfect example. She has de novo disease. We know that patients with de novo metastatic disease, so they never developed any resistance yet, we know that those patients have a better prognosis than patients who have recurrent disease. So it's very likely that a patient with a biology such as this, strongly estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, is going to do well with her first line hormonal therapy, regardless of what that is. So do you need to be using a CDK inhibitor in a patient who's probably going to be on their first-line therapy for 2 or 3 years without that CDK inhibitor? What are you bringing to the table by adding a CDK inhibitor to that person? You're obviously adding extra toxicity. Are you meaningfully going to improve their long-term outcome by adding the CDK inhibitor from the get-go? We know that CDK inhibitors work in the second-line setting. Is it appropriate to hold off until that situation? And I personally think it is. The hazard rates for CDK inhibition are the same in first line versus second line. We know that they're active drugs. And for a person like this, who I think is going to do well on an aromatase inhibitor or tamoxifen for a while and doesn't have a big burden of disease, so you don't really, you know, you're not trying to maximize response rate, I think it's okay to defer adding the CDK inhibitor until the next line of therapy. But that all being said, for most of our patients who present with recurrent disease, given the very strong data from Paloma-2 and from the Mona Lisa trials in the first-line setting, I think most of our patients, we should be adding the CDK inhibitor in the first-line, but not everybody. The people who you think are going to do well on hormonal therapy alone, people who you're worried about toxicity because of other problems with CDK inhibitors, I think it's perfectly fine to start out with hormonal therapy alone and use the CDKs later.
So what about choice? How do you decide between palbo and ribo? What do we know about abema? And if that becomes approved, then how are you going to make that decision?
Yeah, so it's already hard enough with two, and then we're going to have three. I mean, based on the data that George Sledge presented at ASCO about second line abema, which looked very good, we already know from press releases that the first line abema study also, I think, is going to be positive. So presumably it will also eventually be approved. So we're going to have three CDK4/6 inhibitors. How are you going to pick which one to use? It's remarkable that the hazard rates for these drugs are essentially identical for most of the studies in first and second line. You know, they're all around 0.5. And the absolute benefits have been a little different from one trial to another, but I think that's probably because of the populations that each trial used. So it looks like the efficacy is pretty similar. The toxicity between ribo and palbo also look incredibly similar in terms of percentages of significant neutropenia. The only difference I see comparing palbo to ribo is that ribo does have these rare instances of LFT abnormalities and potential for QTC prolongation. Again, they're quite rare, so I'm not sure that should be a driving decision force. But clinicians should probably think of these drugs as being fairly identical right now, unless something in longer-term follow-up comes out to suggest that they're different.
What about abema? Of course, you guys have done a lot of the research on the drug, and the thing that always I thought was fascinating was, I don't know, people didn't seem to be that excited, but I thought it was cool that it caused monotherapy responses, which you didn't see with the other two. What do you think about that, and how would you integrate that if it became approved?
Yeah, so you're right that we did participate in some of those early studies with abema. My colleague Sarah Tulaney led a few of those. And unlike the other two drugs, abema does have a single agent response rate of 20-something percent in pretreated patients, and the other ones don't. Abema is given continuously, whereas the other ones are intermittent schedule. So we actually thought that abema actually may distinguish itself, and it does in terms of toxicity. It doesn't have nearly as much neutropenia. It's got, you know, less than half the rate of serious neutropenia as ribo and palbo, but it does have more diarrhea. You know, in the data that Dr. Sledge presented, the grade 3 diarrhea rate was something like 13%, which the other drugs don't have. It's like 1% in those. So it's a different toxicity profile. To be honest, I was a little disappointed in that the abema data looked so similar to the ribo and palbo data in terms of hazard rates. I kind of thought it might be a little better. So I really don't think, despite the fact that there is this monotherapy activity, I think from the large data sets we have, it's hard to get too dogmatic that one drug should be used versus another. Unless, you know, somebody's not tolerating one, you could consider switching to the other abema once it gets approved.
So I don't know if we're going to get to your PARP case, but I mean, there are three PARP inhibitors out there too. So it's not, you know, that just became approved in the last year. So a number of situations kind of like that where multiple drugs are available. Let's talk about, though, first a little bit about HER2 positive disease. And you had a 52-year-old lady, maybe we can take a look at in terms of the way you approached her.
Yeah, so she actually was very much of a bread and butter type of patient that we've seen a lot over the last few years. So this is a 52-year-old woman who, very healthy, had a mammographically detected stage one. It was a T1. I think she was like 1.4 centimeter. HER2 positive, hormone receptor negative cancer, who had a negative sentinel lymph node, did not have lymphovascular invasion, but it was a poorly differentiated cancer. So it was a typical HER2 amplified breast cancer, but stage one. And this is a relatively common scenario. And in the past, these cancers kind of were a little bit of a black box because the adjuvant trastuzumab trials all mainly focused on high-risk patients. They didn't include these lower-risk patients. So there really wasn't a standard of care for this population. But on the other hand, we know from retrospective data sets that these still do have a significant risk of recurrence in the absence of treatment. So you can't blow them off. But giving them TCH or ACTH always seemed like overkill. So based on that, Sarah Tulaney and Eric Weiner and our group led this 400-patient trial where they took patients with largely stage one, although there were a few patients who had cancers between 2 and 3 centimeters, but all node negative, and treated them with 12 weeks of paclitaxel and a year of trastuzumab, with the idea that what we really need to do is give them the trastuzumab and a little chemotherapy is probably going to be enough. You didn't really need to give the multiple chemotherapy agent type of regimen. And the trial was designed to show that this regimen was associated with a low risk of toxicity. Sarah presented the data a few years ago and published it, showing incredibly good outcomes after roughly 4 years of follow-up. And now at ASCO this year, she presented the 7-year follow-up data. You know, we always had the concern that, well, they're small cancers, so maybe they need longer to recur. So maybe we'll start seeing higher recurrence rates over time, but we did not see that. So at 7 years, the recurrence of distant recurrence risk was 1%, which, you know, I think is quite impressive. And it really says that this regimen, which is very well tolerated, really should be the standard of care for most of our stage one HER2 positive patients. It's really hard to argue that they need more treatment with a 1% distant recurrence rate at 7 years.
And we certainly have seen the widespread adaptation of this so-called APT regimen to practice. However, there are a couple things that have come up recently related to higher risk patients, particularly node positive disease. At least I think that's the way people are viewing this. And obviously one is the AFFINITY trial that was presented and then published. It was presented at ASCO looking at adjuvant pertuzumab, and then was the approval of post-adjuvant neratinib, and I'd like your take on both of those developments.
Yeah, so after not much change in a long time in the adjuvant setting, we have a couple new developments. And so, right, so going from the low-risk patient population of APT, now we're going the opposite with Extenet and AFFINITY. So we all had very high hopes for pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting. You know, the data in the metastatic setting are as good as any trial we've ever seen, with the CLEOPATRA trial in terms of a 16-month improvement in survival. The neoadjuvant setting, pertuzumab doubles the pass CR rate when added to trastuzumab. So again, we thought this really was going to be a very positive trial. And I'm on the steering committee for AFFINITY, so I'm biased. But even still, I think we thought the data were a little disappointing. It was a positive study, but the hazard rate, you know, was 0.8 or 0.81, and the absolute differences were small. So just to remind everybody, so AFFINITY was a randomized trial of mostly higher risk patients, but a decent number of smaller node-negative patients were included. And the trial randomized patients to your choice of either an anthracycline or non-anthracycline regimen with trastuzumab or trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And these were the first data that were presented. And as I said, the hazard rate was 0.81. It met statistical significance, but just barely. And the absolute benefit was small. Really no benefit in node-negative patients. And in node-positive patients, the absolute benefit at 3 years was a couple percent, not even quite 2%. So, yeah, I guess we've just come in a world where, you know, last few targeted therapy trials have all come in with hazard rates of 0.6 and 0.5, that 0.8 doesn't seem quite as impressive. But I think the biggest problem, which is not a problem, is that the control arm did incredibly well. And that's just the state of the affair right now in HER2-positive disease, is that trastuzumab-based chemotherapy works very well. And so it's hard to improve upon that substantially when your control arm patients are fortunately doing well.
So let's think about a patient, for example, who has, say, two positive nodes, Let's say they're ER negative, HER2 positive, and you're going to give them adjuvant chemo and trastuzumab, okay? So once you do that, what would you estimate to be their residual risk of recurrence, you know, globally, with your own clinical ballpark guess? And how do you think that would be affected by, we could say ER positive or ER negative, incidentally, how do you think that would be affected by either pertuzumab being added to adjuvant or neratinib used in the back end after adjuvant?
Yeah, and so let me just, you know, whereas the data, I just want to be clear for people who may not have seen or read the affinity data. Some people took from that that the benefit was all in the ER negative patients in affinity. And really, I think the biggest thing was that the ER positives just had a low event rate, because the hazard rates between ER positive and ER negative really wasn't that different. It was like 0.845 for ER positives and 0.76 for ER negative. So I don't think ER status seemed to predict benefit of pertuzumab very much. It was mostly just risk. Low-risk patients didn't get a benefit, at least so far. So in your patient with two nodes, in terms of recurrence risk, I think HER2-positive patients recur earlier than HER2-negative patients, but there's still a rate of recurrence over time. So you have to look at what time frame you're talking about. But I think over 10 years, you know, her risk of recurrence is probably, with a trastuzumab-based regimen, 10 or 12%. That's an estimate. So in that patient, I actually would give her pertuzumab. In general, I think it's reasonable, based on the affinity data, to use pertuzumab in most of our node-positive patients, certainly with multiple nodes positive.
But then I guess you would assume that it's only going to bump it down a couple percent absolutely.
Right.
And what about post, you know, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, neratinib, to bump it down a little more?
Right. So let's talk about the Extenet. So this was an interesting trial design that looked at patients who'd completed a year of trastuzumab and then randomized patients, mostly node positives, to either a year of neratinib or placebo. And the data that's come out over the last few years show that there was a substantial improvement by hazard rate with the addition of neratinib. Absolute differences were not huge, but definitely there. And interestingly, unlike affinity, in which hormone receptor status didn't seem to make a difference or a large difference, in neratinib, essentially all the benefit was in ER positives, which is counter to what we've seen in some other HER2-directed therapy studies. But the difference is quite striking. It's pretty much black or white there. So, and as you mentioned, based on the Extenet data, neratinib was just approved by the FDA. So who would I use neratinib in? I think given its toxicity profile and the fact that most patients do pretty well on trastuzumab, and pertuzumab is going to knock that down a few points as well, I'm really going to reserve it for the highest risk patients, patients with many nodes positive, and probably mostly ER positives. Although my sense is the label was in both ER positive and ER negative.
Right, yeah, I didn't specify. I think it didn't even specify the time, although I assume you wouldn't want, I don't know how long after somebody stopped, if they came to you for a second opinion, it was a year later, would you do it? You have to look at the numbers, I guess.
So you have to look at the numbers, and I think the Extenet group is looking at those kinds of things, you know, how much the, whether there was a differential benefit in patients who had a lag or didn't have a lag or other kind. We don't have any biomarker data yet. I think we're all expecting that to come out soon. So hopefully we'll have a little bit more information. But I think for the average person coming through now, I think neratinib does offer a benefit for high-risk patients.
I was just thinking, I was going to ask you, if you were going to use neratinib, what would you do in terms of prevention or detection or management of diarrhea? And I was just wondering, I wonder what it's going to be like to deal with a diarrhea neratinib after the diarrhea of pertuzumab. But anyhow, what would you do?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that the neratinib investigators have done a lot of work in trying to prevent the diarrhea, because we all know that it's a problem for patients. Now there's a very strict primary prophylaxis with Imodium, and we're also talking about using a steroid, an oral steroid as well, which also seems to help. So I think it's something that's continuing to be worked on, but certainly a primary prophylaxis with Imodium is really important. And that's now built into all of the neratinib studies and should be part of clinical use as well.
So I was going to ask you before, because we were talking about APT, you now have the SONA APT, so to speak, trial where you're comparing it to T-DM1. I'm just kind of curious, clinically, do you find that patients who go on that trial, you know, in the adjuvant setting, do better with T-DM1 or APT?
So the trial you're mentioning, which is called the ATTEMPT study, is a study that randomized patients, similar population to APT, so, you know, stage one HER2-positive patients, randomized them to T-DM1 for a year or the same paclitaxel trastuzumab. And so we've finished enrollment. We're just waiting for the data to mature. The idea was to see if you, by using T-DM1, could you get rid of all of the standard chemotherapy toxicity so patients don't lose their hair. It was a very well-received trial. Patients really liked not having hair loss, which is a big concern for many women in the adjuvant setting. And, you know, so I think it was a, patients felt that it was, a very reasonable approach, and we're now waiting for the data to mature. So I can't tell you efficacy yet because, you know, it takes time. I think it was part of this idea of further de-escalating therapy for these HER2-positive patients.
Well, that was really my question, which is, if you do believe, after seeing the efficacy data, that they're the same, would you choose T-DM1? Do you think it's, easier on the patient?
Well, and I should clarify that the actual trial design is not to compare the efficacy of the two, because we know that we expect that the event rates are going to be very low, so you're not going to be able to statistically compare. The actual comparison is for toxicity, hoping to show that T-DM1 is less toxic than paclitaxel. The major point of the trial, though, is to show that in a large population of patients, the T-DM1 is associated with a very low recurrence rate, similarly to what we did with APT.
But again, if that's what's seen, you think you would prefer T-DM1?
I probably would. I think patients would. And more importantly, I think patients will prefer it. I think there's the reimbursement, and this is not a registration trial. So if T-DM1 isn't approved in the early disease setting based on some other trial, several of which are underway, I think it's going to be hard to be able to give patients T-DM1 in that setting. But if that shows a very low recurrence rate, that it would be something that would be appealing to patients.
So I have to, another thing I saw that I guess a trial, single arm phase 2 study that's being done, that's kind of surprised me. I've been trying to figure out sort of where enzalutamide and androgen receptors fit in nowadays, but I see that you've got this study looking at enzalutamide with trastuzumab, which I think is really interesting.
You know of the data with triple negative AR positive patients. Clearly, enzalutamide had some activity in those patients. We presented data with, as you mentioned, of enzalutamide with trastuzumab, and there was some activity there as well. And there's another trial that's been completed that's randomized of aromatase inhibitor with or without enzalutamide in ER positive patients, because AR is very prevalent on ER positive breast cancers. At the same time, there's actually drugs stimulating AR. That's also a drug called GTX-024 or enobosarm, which is an agonist of androgen receptor that's also being tested in ER-positive cancers. So the bottom line is AR is probably fairly complicated in its mechanism, particularly in ER-positive patients, but it's commonly expressed across breast cancers, less so in triple-negative, but certainly in some. And, I think it's an open question right now whether there's really going to be a strong, enough of a signal there to make it worth further pursuing. And as I said, I don't have the keys to enzalutamide, but there will be more data to come. And so we hope to present the ER-positive data set soon, and maybe that will change people's mind. Again, I don't know what the situation is.
That's really interesting. So I want to finish out with your thoughts about, again, the Olympiad data. I see that you have a patient who actually, a 40-year-old woman who actually participated in the study, and looks like she was on it for about 9 months. I had, initially stable disease, minor response. I was curious, though, what happened with her tolerability-wise. I see she had some GI problems, some neutropenia, and what your experience is, if, I don't know how much experience you have right now with olaparib or PARP inhibitors in breast cancer in terms of tolerability.
This particular patient, as you said, had a recurrence after chemo. She's triple negative with a BRCA1, a classic Ashkenazi BRCA1 mutation, and had a recurrence a few years after adjuvant chemotherapy. And as first line, she was on that trial and got randomized to olaparib and had a little bit of a response, but on it for 9 months. She had some mild diarrhea and fatigue, but she continued to work, and the neutropenia really wasn't a clinically significant problem. I mean, this is triple negative breast cancer. The alternative is chemotherapy or a trial. Compared to chemotherapy, the olaparib was quite appealing. I thought it was very much of a win for her, and I'm glad the trial was positive and the drug will be approved for breast cancer. I mean, it's unfortunately, the hope had always been that PARP inhibitors will work outside of the BRCA1 and 2 mutation carriers, but that, at least so far, that doesn't seem to be the case. you know, clearly for this particular subset of breast cancers, it's an active drug. And I think the tolerability is fine, you know, relative to what else we use in the metastatic setting. So I think it's a good thing for our patients that that drug will become available for BRCA carriers. And, you know, we're still, I think many investigators are still working hard to try to figure out, can you use these drugs to, in combination with other agents to work outside of the BRCA subsets?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was telling Dr. Robeson of our experience in doing CME in ovarian cancer. We've worked with your colleague Ursula Matulonis a lot, for example. And of course, in ovary, it's a very different story. It looks like maybe everybody benefits, but, you know, it's a completely different cancer. I'm curious right now, the way you're thinking through your clinical algorithm, if olaparib is approved, as you say, it seems like it should be, for both triple negative and ER positive, HER2 negative, where do you think you're going to be thinking about olaparib?
In terms of line of therapy?
Yeah, with BRCA germline patients.
I think it's probably going to be first line. At least that'd be my plan. I mean, you know, we always want to use the least toxic therapy that is active. And, you know, none of these drugs have shown survival benefits. So I don't think the schedule is so important or the sequence is so important. So for triple negatives, I would probably use it first line. For ER positives, you know, the benefit actually was a little less, it looked like, in Olympiad. And so I still would stick with hormonal therapy first and use that as a way to stave off chemotherapy once patients have progressed on hormonal therapy.